Harry took a slow breath in. At 7 weeks, you know that that fetus has a long way to go before it becomes a baby.
I know that, said Aisling, her voice low but cracking with suppressed anger, fear and frustration.
I keep telling myself that it's nothing more than a little scrap of raw material, smaller than a coffee bean, but that's not helping me.
She glanced around. This was not the place to have this conversation.
Even if it's just a bundle of cells, it's more than nothing, right? It's the last bit of Jack left in the world. If I leave it alone, just do nothing, then that thing, that little bit of potential, it'll grow to be Jack's baby, won't it? So if I have an abortion, how is that not the same thing?
The words were muddled, her thinking confused, but it was still the closest she'd come to articulating how she had been feeling for the past 2 weeks.
You're calling it Jack's baby, Mary said. Not yours. Not yours and Jack's.
Aisling said nothing, and Mary chewed her bottom lip. There was a little smear of makeup on her collar. She was wearing more than usual, and she looked tired under the heavy layer of foundation.
If Jack was alive, would you be going ahead with this pregnancy?
The answer, a clear, unhesitating no, was in Aisling's head before she had a chance to consciously consider the question. No way would she be considering having a baby if Jack was still with her. She'd had a moment, a wobble, on the night before he died, but that was to be expected, wasn't it? Normal to try to consider all of the options. It did not mean that she wanted to be a mother. Even though they hadn't had a chance to work it out, she thought he would have supported that decision in the end. And if he hadn't? Would she have risked their relationship rather than have a baby now, at 25, before she'd realized even one of her ambitions? Mary read the answer in her face.
Aisling, this is your decision, but for God's sake, don't have a baby out of some sort of misplaced survivor's guilt.
She placed a pointed index finger right in the middle of the chart Aisling had been working on.
You lose this,
Mary said, and she sounded angry, had raised her voice.
You lose everything you've worked for, so you'll have to choose another path.
She paused, took her finger back from the chart, and continued in a softer voice.
You could try for GP, although they won't be thrilled about being your second choice. If you show you're committed, you'll get in, and in a year or two, you'll be out of the hospital and in a practice, seeing 30 patients a day, most of whom aren't really sick. They just want someone who'll listen to them for a while, and you'll be able to give them exactly 12.5 minutes, because you'll need the last 2.5 minutes of the 15-minute appointment to complete the paperwork.
Aisling felt cold and hot at the same time. A clammy nausea gripped her stomach.
I know all this. I know all of this. Well?
Mary fell silent, looked back at her paperwork. You did it, Aisling said. You left surgery for general medicine. You can't feel that way about it.
I don't. Not exactly.
Mary grimaced, looked up at Aisling with a return of her frustration.
The truth is that I don't have what you have, Aisling. Jesus, you never give up. Do you remember when we were interns and we both worked that awful week? Everyone had flu but us, it felt like, and we worked something like 120 hours.
Aisling nodded slowly, though she didn't remember exactly. There had been a lot of long weeks. Everything sort of ran into everything else when you worked that hard on that little sleep. We left together that Saturday morning, walked out of the place and went for breakfast across the road. I went home afterwards and I slept until Monday morning, basically. Only got up to eat and use the loo.
Aisling nodded. Mary shook her head. That Monday was the deadline for the Wiley Medal, which you won. Jack told me later that you wrote your essay that weekend. You stayed up all night Sunday to finish it. But we worked on Monday morning and you came in and did a 14-hour shift with me as if it was nothing. The Wiley Medal is awarded by the fucking Association of Anaesthetists, for Christ's sake. You wanted to be a surgeon.
There was prize money, Aisling said, folding her arms across her chest.
Mary snorted, rolled her eyes.
Aisling had to fight the urge to just walk away.
You always win, not just the medal. You won the Henry Hutch twice. You're what, second, third in the country right now? How do you do that?
Aisling wanted to say that second or third wasn't first, wasn't winning. It was on the tip of her tongue. There's no secret, Mary. I just work bloody hard.
I work hard, Mary snapped back. Harder than almost anyone, but you're fucking superhuman.
She looked back down at her paperwork, face flushed. Was she embarrassed? Or just angry? The conversation had spiraled from its starting point. Whatever Mary had set out to say, it wasn't this. How long had she been feeling like this? It was too much to deal with on top of everything else. No one would blame her if Aisling told her to fuck off, if she just walked away right now. But Aisling thought about that hand on her shoulder at the cemetery, when she'd needed it most. My mother used to apologize to my teachers, Aisling said.
What?
At the start of every year, she would come to my school to meet the teachers and apologize for me. I'm very sorry about Aisling. I'm afraid she has very little ability, though I'm sure she does her best.
She started doing that when I was 8.
Mary looked back at her, fascinated, horrified.
It didn't really matter what my teachers said. If they said something positive about me, my mother would cock her head to one side and smile in a grateful sort of a way. Then afterwards she would explain to me that my teachers were being kind, and they only did that for the kids who couldn't hack it.
Aisling paused. I think I was actually quite a good student, even then.
But that's crazy.
Aisling shrugged. I think she believed it. But she felt the same way about herself, you know? I suppose now I would label it maybe low self-esteem and transference, but at the time I just accepted it. For a long time I accepted everything she said. And then I started to get angry.
I bet you did, said Mary.
I started working harder. I worked my ass off, to be honest. I was absolutely determined that my mother would finally see I was good enough. The day my leaving cert results came in, my mother had this puzzled look on her face. She said congratulations. Then, that night, after I went to bed, I heard her ask my dad if there could have been some sort of mix-up, if maybe they should do the right thing and let the exam board know. Mary laughed, a horrified gasp of laughter that escaped and was bitten back. But the laugh was good. It loosened something in Aisling, and she smiled back. I'd like to say I got over it then, but I didn't really. For a long, long time after that, I was still trying to prove something. Things got better after I met Jack. But by then, I don't know. Maybe working that hard is a habit now. Or maybe I am still trying to please her. Christ, that's pathetic.
You're the furthest thing from pathetic I know,
Mary said, her tone warm and firm.
And the truth is, it's not just hard work that's gotten you here. I know you've got talent. In spades. You're going to make an incredible surgeon. You're going to save a lot of lives.
She stopped, stumbling over her last words, and silence fell between them. Aisling wanted to say something, but nothing came out. The two women regarded each other for a long moment.
Just be sure you make a plan, Aisling.
A plan for the next step and the next one and then the one after that, okay?
And remember that you've got a friend here if you need one.
Mary squeezed Aisling's shoulder in what was becoming a familiar gesture, then hopped lightly from the desk and walked away down the corridor. Aisling stood still. A plan.
She needed to make a plan.
The pager beeped again. Chapter 14. Cormac made his way back to the station, irritated that he'd brought the car and had to sit in traffic instead of walking. He hadn't made much progress on the case, but for the first time thought that there was progress to make. Collins was definitely hiding something. And he was loyal to Maud, or at least wanted Cormac to think so. He needed to think through what that might mean. Cormac's stomach growled as he parked outside the station and he checked his watch. It was nearly 3, and he hadn't eaten since breakfast. The few pints he'd had the night before had left him with a heavy head, and he'd been drinking coffee all day. Food was definitely in order. He took a detour to the 4th floor and the somewhat limited canteen. The place was usually deserted at this time of the day because the hot food finished at 2. But when Cormac entered in search of a sandwich, he found Anthony Healy occupying one corner table, A file spread out in front of him, two empty coffee cups at his elbow. Cormac ignored him, walked to the fridge and examined the meager pickings. Egg salad. Beetroot salad. Who the fuck ate beetroot salad? He took a limp ham sandwich, a sliver of processed meat stuck between two thin white slices of bread. Ireland had come a long way over the past 10 years, but the food revolution had not broached the Gartha canteen.
Riley!
Cormac took his time pressing buttons on the coffee machine before turning to Healy as his cup filled.
How long do you think you'll last down here in the boonies?
Cormac said nothing, waited.
Come on, no bullshit. This lot don't know their arse from their elbow. What are you doing here? Is it really all about a woman? That's a bit out of character, isn't it?
Cormac added a leisurely 2 spoons of sugar to his coffee. Stirred.
Is it?
He said. Healy laughed, as if Cormac had made a joke.
Seriously, man, isn't it a bit slow for you? You've been here, what, a month, two? Are you really going to stick it?
I haven't noticed much difference. Same bullshit. Same politics.
Cormac paused.
But you'd know the place better than me. Task Force seems to like Galway. Third visit in 3 years, isn't it? Is it the weather that brings you back?
The rain was lashing against the windows in one of those sudden violent flurries that added variety to the otherwise near constant drizzle. Healy laughed again, shook his head.
I'd tell you, Cormac, he said, but then I'd have to shoot you.
He patted the gun at his side. Cormac, bored with the posturing, turned to go. He'd reached the door when Healy spoke again.
You're very friendly with Danny McIntyre. Knew him before you transferred.
Cormac turned, looked at Healy, and Healy stared back. There was a world behind that question. Healy was far too experienced, too tough, to show any of the frustration that might have prompted his words, but he surely felt it. This whole conversation had been an inept attempt to warm Cormac up, and when that showed no signs of working, he'd just blurted the question out. What was it about Danny that had Healy going? That he wasn't one of Healy's little minions? That he had a degree of independence and a mind of his own? Surely Healy was capable of keeping one temporary assignee under control. No, Danny had to have seen something, and Healy was worried that he might have talked. As Cormac hesitated, Healy broke eye contact and started gathering up his files. At the same moment, a trio of uniforms came in. One of them almost taking out Cormac's rapidly cooling coffee. The moment had passed, and Cormac wasn't even sure what it had been. He left the room before Healy, returned to his desk, and made short work of the sandwich. He was finishing his coffee when Fisher appeared at his desk, some printed pages in his hands.
I found him, Fisher said, without preamble. Timothy Lanigan. He did go to Massachusetts, but he didn't stay there. He moved to New York State, taught in,
Fisher paused to look at his notes.
St. Boniface Catholic Academy, private school. He taught English and coached soccer. He married one of the other teachers, had 2 kids, and stayed there for 10 years. In 1985, his marriage broke down and he moved away. His wife, ex-wife, still works at the school.
And?
Cormac said.
And it looks like he's pretty clean, don't you think? Taught for 10 years, no scandals. He got divorced in 1985 and left the area soon after.
Fisher shrugged.
Law-abiding citizen. Not much to work with.
Where is he now?
Cormac asked. Fisher made a helpless gesture.
I don't know, he said. I found him online, some old soccer reports, photos, called the school, got the secretary talking.
His expression said he thought he'd done well.
I didn't take it any further. I asked you to find him. Don't stop until you do.
Cormac made a mental note to make a phone call or two to his own contacts. Fisher was good, and he wanted to push him, but getting information from the States quickly would require a bit of pull. Fisher opened his mouth to speak, then stopped himself.
Ask,
Cormac said.
It's just, what's the point of it?
Fisher asked. To his credit, there was no complaint in his voice, just honest curiosity.
There's no DNA, no new evidence. Isn't this a waste of time?
Cormac smiled, and the smile turned into a yawn which he smothered with one hand.
If you start thinking like that,
that all you're doing is shutting yourself down. When you're investigating, you follow the questions until you have answers.
He picked up the Blake file. Fisher took the hint and left. Cormac's little lecture to the younger man had been a timely reminder. He needed to press on. He found the number for Child and Family Services in Castle Bar and picked up the phone. Chapter 15. Aisling didn't get home that night until after 8 o'clock. After her conversation with Mary, she'd turned her tired mind from the questions she'd raised and refocused on her work. After her A&E shift, she'd made a round of every surgical ward on her floor. She'd read the charts of 18 patients, spoken to those who were awake, had a chat with family members, and caught up with colleagues, until she finally felt that everything was as it should be. Her finger was back on the pulse of the hospital, and for the first time since Jack died, she felt a little in control. She was also exhausted. Her feet hurt. The pad of her right foot ached like a bruise every time she took a step. Her back was tight, and her eyes were burning. Her stomach felt hard and raw with hunger. She hadn't had a chance to eat since breakfast, 13 hours earlier. She was struggling with the lock on her door, trying to see the keyhole in the dark, when a voice spoke from behind her. Aisling. Aisling knew who it was before she turned, and she closed her eyes briefly. Shit. She didn't have the energy. Then she turned and found a smile from somewhere.
Aggie. Aisling hugged the smaller woman. Have you been waiting? You should have called. I would have come home earlier.
I knew you were working.
Aggie gave Aisling a searching look.
You're tired, and I'll bet you haven't eaten. Well, I can solve one problem.
She raised the carrier bag she held in one hand and looked beyond Aisling to the front door. They sat in the kitchen and ate together. The contents of the carrier bag turned out to be 2 lunchboxes filled with brown stew and mashed potato. Aisling plated them, nuked them, and offered Aggie a glass of wine, which she refused.
I'll have water, love. I'm driving.
They ate in silence for the first few minutes, Aisling with a sudden urgency that she knew Aggie wouldn't miss. She slowed herself down after the first few mouthfuls, became conscious of the dirty dishes stacked in the sink, the single brown banana in the fruit bowl, the clothes still hanging on the clothes horse, which included 2 of Jack's t-shirts. She hadn't done any laundry since the day he died. Aisling glanced at Aggie, half expecting to see those grey eyes taking in the mess or watching her, measuring the degree to which she was falling apart. Except that she wasn't falling apart, or no more than should be expected. She was just bloody busy. But Aggie's eyes were on her own plate, and it was Aisling who started doing the noticing, the measuring. Aggie had been crying, and recently her eyes were still puffy. Her soft grey hair was tidy, and her blouse and cardigan had been neatly pressed, but there was a little stain on the lapel that was very un-Aggie, and she looked tired. Aggie finished her food, then reached out a hand and softly squeezed Aisling's.
I'm sorry we left it to you, she said. The guards. Unforgivable. But I wasn't thinking straight, Aisling. I hope you'll forgive me.
Not at all.
Aisling started to rattle off an automatic denial, but a second squeeze of her hand and the expression on Aggie's face stopped her.
I'm sorry for it, Aggie said. If I could have the time over, I'd do it differently. But I felt Brendan needed me, and I used it as an excuse to turn away.
Aisling stood and went to the kettle. She filled it, turned it on, then started to clear the plates.
I don't blame you for anything, she said. Losing Jack, I know it broke your heart. You're doing the best you can.
When she looked back at Aggie, she saw eyes filled with unshed tears and wanted to cry herself. Aggie was the warmest of women. Utterly practical, hard-working, she'd loved Jack fiercely and welcomed Aisling with a kind word and a warm hand when he'd first brought her to the house. They were such different women on the surface, and Aisling had wondered if Aggie would have preferred a different kind of woman for her son. But Jack had only laughed when she'd said this to him.
She's not that sort of person, was all he had said,
And in time, Aisling had come to see that Aggie wanted only happiness for Jack, and if Aisling made him happy, that was good enough for her. But she wasn't the type to express emotion easily. Now Aggie blinked back her tears and took a cup, poured tea for them both. "How are you doing?" she asked. "Working hard, I know. But are you looking after yourself? Have you seen much of Mark and Fergus? Have they been round?" Jack's friends. They'd both called, Fergus more than once. She hadn't answered the phone, hadn't called them back, hadn't seen them since the funeral. "Maud was there, at the Garda meeting." Aisling blurted the words out. "She came back. She's been in Australia all this time." Aggie put her cup down on the table. "Maud? Jack's sister, Maud?" Aisling nodded and took a seat opposite Aggie. She held her cup in her hands, wrapped her fingers around its warmth. "She looks like him." "Did she?" "Not at all, really. Not when Aisling thought about it. Maud was small, slight, where Jack had been tall and athletic. Maud was older, and there was nothing of Jack's laughing eyes about her. But it was in her eyes that Aisling saw Jack. Something about the set of them, the stillness of her expression. That had been Jack, too, in a moment of distraction, when his mind was far away.
"She came home."
"When?" Aisling shook her head. "I don't know. She must have heard about Jack, come for the funeral. She was there, you know, on Prospect Hill. But I didn't recognize her." It was Aggie's turn to shake her head. "Poor, poor girl," she said. "She finally came home, and Jack is gone." There were no tears in Aggie's eyes now. Her face was grey, her lips bloodless. She took a sip from her cup, closed her eyes for a moment.
"Will she meet us, do you think? I'd like to see her. I want to show her the photographs. She should know that Jack had a happy life, that coming to us was a good thing for him, that it wasn't all a waste."
Then confusion crossed her face and tears welled again. She blinked against them.
"Well, I always thought it wasn't, but perhaps we were wrong about that."
She turned, eyes filled with pain, to Aisling.
"Did he talk to you, Aisling? Do you know why he would do this terrible thing?"
"Aggie," Aisling said. She pushed back her chair and stood, glanced to the kitchen. She wanted to be doing something, felt an urge to wash up the dishes, anything to break the tension of the moment. What should she say? Would it be wrong to give false hope? And how could it be false hope to tell someone that maybe their son hadn't killed himself after all, maybe he'd just been murdered? Jesus! She sat again, took her cup in both hands, held it and looked down, concentrated on the grip of her fingers, the lightening of her flesh as she tightened her grip, the encroaching pink as she loosened it.
"Aggie," she said again, "Maud doesn't think, I mean, I'm not sure."
She forced herself to look up.
"I'm not certain that Jack did kill himself."
Aggie stared back at her, mouth slightly open as if she were about to ask a question.
"I don't know what you mean," she said in the end.
So Aisling told her the story, starting with the CCTV footage, then doubling back to the meeting with Rogers, then back again to her conversation with Maud in the hotel room. In the end, the story was so muddled, she didn't think that Aggie would be able to make anything out of it. When she finished, Aggie sat back, cup of tea forgotten, her cheeks flushed. She said nothing for what felt like a long time, and when she spoke, she blurted the words out.
"I want to meet her," Aggie said.
"What?"
"Maud. I'd like to meet her. I always wanted to meet her. Can you call her? Bring her for lunch, on Saturday, or Sunday if you're working."
Aisling wondered for a second if she should start again, make a better effort of it this time, but Aggie reached over and took her hand.
"I want to believe he didn't do it," she said. "The world would make sense again. Even though that means someone else hurt him, killed him. But it's all too much. I don't know where to start with it.
But I know I want to see Maud, so I'll start with that and see where to go from there.
Aisling found herself agreeing, promising to call Maud in the morning to try to set up the lunch whenever it suited Aggie. And after that, Aggie insisted on washing up, tidying the kitchen, folding the clothes. She was flooded with a sudden energy and sent Aisling protesting to the shower. By the time Aisling came downstairs again, dressed in her last pair of clean pajamas and her hair wrapped in a towel, the kitchen was cleaner than it had been in weeks, and Aggie was packed up and ready to go. She kissed Aisling briskly on the cheek.
"I'll see you on Saturday," she said. "Don't be late, or be late. It doesn't matter."
She laughed an uncharacteristically nervous laugh, then cut it abruptly short. It occurred to Aisling that maybe Aggie had had those moments too. Those moments of horrible self-consciousness, of guilt, of self-censorship, as if outward grief were a borrowed suit that never quite fit. But she was too tired to follow the thought through, too tired to do anything more than hug Aggie goodbye and shut the door. She was too tired even to climb the stairs and face her empty bed. She went to the living room and lay down on the couch, pulled a blanket over herself and fell asleep there, wet hair and all, and slept until morning. Wednesday, 27th of March, 2013. Chapter 16. Children and Family Services didn't return Cormac's call on Tuesday, and his second call on Tuesday evening had gotten him nowhere. His third call on Wednesday morning got him an answer, if not the one he was looking for. The voice on the other end of the phone was still chirpy, efficient.
"Oh, hi, Detective Riley. I was about to call you. Yeah, there's no file, I'm afraid. I mean, there was one, but it was in the flood."
"The flood?"
"Yeah, in Castlebar, 2009. The storage facility was out by the river and it burst its banks, flooded the place. They did try to recover the files, but then there was some sort of problem with mould, so they had to be destroyed."
"You don't have copies, scans?"
"Not of stuff going that far back, I'm afraid." There was distraction in her voice, and he could hear conversation in the background. A moment later, she apologised briefly again and hung up. Cursing, Cormac left the station and walked into Galway, waiting until he had crossed the bridge and found a doorway that offered enough shelter from the wind for a phone call. He dialed a number he hadn't called in nearly 5 years. She answered after two rings.
"Cormac?"
Surprise in her voice, a hint of concern. "Everything all right?" She'd recognized his number, but then he would have recognized hers.
"Tara, how are you?"
"Grand. I'm grand." He'd heard through the grapevine that she was married now, to a guy who worked in banking. The marriage hadn't surprised him, the banking part had, a bit. Tara had never been a big fan of suits. She was bloody good at her job, but as she'd advanced up the ranks, she'd never let go of the fact that she'd started in the trenches, while so many of the middle and upper management types she encountered had no clue what it was like on the front line. Maybe she'd gotten over her aversion, now that so many of them worked for her. Her last promotion had made her Director of Policy and Strategy at the Child and Family Agency.
"I heard you got married,"
Cormac said. "Yeah, Paul. Lovely guy. I think you'd like him." She spoke a little awkwardly, then rushed out with, "We're expecting."
"Congrats, Tara. That's great news."
He was genuinely happy for her. It was what she'd wanted from the beginning, really. She'd never pretended otherwise, and he'd always felt guilty that it had taken him so long to realize he didn't feel the same way. "And you?" she asked. He really didn't want to get into it.
"Tara, I'm sorry to call you out of the blue like this, but I'm working a case, and I'm hoping you can do me a favor."
"Yes?" There was a caution in her tone, but she wasn't pissed off. So, he told her about the case, that he'd put in a request for a file, an old one from 20 years back, but it had been destroyed. Did she have access to any information from Dublin that she could pass to him? Silence for a moment from the other end of the phone.
"Cormac, you should be able to get that information through the proper channels. You don't need to come through the back door."
Meaning that the back door was now closed?
It's important, Tara. I know it seems like it shouldn't be with a 20-year-old file, but I think there's urgency here. The boy is dead, and something from his past may be relevant.
Cormac, he cut her off.
Tara, there's something off here. I have a feeling.
He cursed himself inwardly. His feelings had been the cause of more than one argument when they prompted his early departure from one special occasion or another. But instead of hanging up on him, she paused for a long moment, then asked for a name. He heard the click of keys on a keyboard, then silence as Tara read whatever she saw.
You're telling me that this boy is dead?
Yes.
Death doesn't bring an end to our confidentiality obligations, Tara said. I'm not going to give you anything that would cross that line.
Of course, Cormac said.
She had once before, when a child went missing and Cormac hadn't wanted to wait on a court order. But that was a different case, and those were different times. Tara went silent again. More reading or second thoughts?
There was a file, Tara said. According to the system, it's in storage in Castle Bar.
I was told there was a flood in 2009, that the file was destroyed along with others.
More keyboard clicking down the phone.
There was a flood, all right, Tara said. The file is probably gone. But I think they did manage to scan at least some of them before the originals were destroyed. There's a reference number here. You could put in a request through Dublin. I'll keep an eye on it for you. See what comes up.
It would take at least a week, maybe more.
Is there anything you can tell me now? Cormac asked. Was anything scanned into the system, or if there's a name, a social worker, I can track down locally?
Another pause.
There are a lot of names here. A lot of different caseworkers. I can give you the most recent.
Cormac blew out the breath he hadn't known he was holding.
Thanks, Tara. I appreciate it very much. I'll owe you one.
She gave him the name.
You're always a good cop, Cormac. If you're asking, I'm sure it's for a good reason.
He was surprised how good it felt to hear her say this. They said their goodbyes and he hung up, then immediately dialed again. 30 minutes later, he pulled in outside a neat detached house in Knocknacarra, in the heart of suburbia. Identikit houses stretched away in either direction. There was a small landscaped park opposite the house. Someone had installed a swing set and a miniature set of plastic goals. He knocked on the door, and a moment later it was opened by a woman who was in the process of shrugging on a coat.
Catherine Shelley?
He asked. She nodded.
Detective Sergeant Cormac Riley, he said. I'd like to talk to you about a case you were involved in when you worked out of Castle Bar.
Her face stayed blank for a long moment. I'm not a social worker anymore, she said. I haven't been one for a long time. You should call the office. Someone there will speak to you.
I need to speak to someone who met these children back in the early 90s. I'm told you worked the case. Really, I'm just looking for background, your impressions of the family, whether or not you can remember any associates, that sort of thing.
I really don't think I would remember any details, particularly without the files. I don't think I can help you. She started to close the door. Cormac took a step forward. He didn't smile, but lowered his voice and spoke very seriously.
Look, some questions have been asked about a suspicious death that took place in 1993. I'd like to speak to you now informally, if that's possible.
The implication was obvious and intentional, and she caught it. She hesitated. Do you have identification? He showed her, and she opened the door wider after a cursory glance. He followed her through the hall into the kitchen beyond. The house was warm and inviting, the hall tidy except for a bundle of coats slung over the bottom of the banisters. The kitchen was a welcoming room too, bigger than the front of the house had led Cormac to expect. There was an oversized kitchen table, some good-looking if dated cabinetry, and glass doors that led into a small garden, which was dominated by a kid's trampoline that had seen better days. Catherine took off her coat as she entered the kitchen and hung it on the back of a chair. She was wearing jeans and an old college sweater underneath. Her fair hair was in a careless ponytail. She had to be in her mid-40s, but there was something youthful and outdoorsy about her. My girls are playing in a hockey tournament, she said.
I was going to watch them. I don't have too long.
Cormac nodded, but said nothing, and after hovering awkwardly for a moment, manners or a habit kicked in, and Catherine gestured to him to take a seat and went to put on the kettle.
When did you move to Galway?
He asked. She added tea bags to a teapot.
I met my husband when I was 24. He's from Galway. After we got married, I moved here. I gave up work after I got pregnant. I was glad to give it up. I was burnt out.
She looked at him sharply, as if expecting criticism.
That's not unusual, she said.
The kettle started to whistle, and she leaned back against the counter, her arms crossed.
Which case is it? She asked.
Blake, said Cormac. Maud and Jack Blake.
There was uncertainty in her eyes for a moment, and then her face cleared as recognition hit. She said nothing, but added hot water to the teapot, brought it to the table, then returned to the cabinets for teacups and sugar, and to the fridge for milk.
It was him, then, in the paper. I saw his name and wondered if it was the same Jack Blake I'd known.
She sat at the table, her expression bleak.
What do you want to know?
Cormac held her gaze.
Why weren't the kids taken into care? He asked.
It wasn't the question he'd been intending to ask, but it was what came out. Catherine shook her head.
You're a cop.
I would have thought you'd know better.
Cormac raised an eyebrow.
Since 1996, there have been 4 public inquiries into child welfare in Ireland.
She held up her hands.
I'm not saying they weren't needed, and I'm not saying they didn't expose terrible things, but the media? Jesus! They apply today's thinking to things that happened 20-30 years ago, and they just stoke up outrage. And it's all the fault of the social workers.
Her face flushed.
We didn't even have the Child Care Act until 1991. And how long did it take them to implement that? Years. And the children's referendum was only last year. That barely passed.
People know. They know that we didn't have the power. Before the referendum, the Constitution put the family first. The best interests of the child came second. We couldn't take the children out unless we had done everything possible to keep the family together. And even then, half the time we'd get knocked back in the courts.
He'd jumped in too fast, and now she was defensive. Cormac softened his tone.
Is that why Maud and Jack stayed with their mother? Because of the Constitution?
She stared back at him, still flushed, breathing a little fast.
No, she said at last, then shook her head. Maybe.
She still held the handle of the teapot in one hand, though she hadn't poured. She stared at it now.
Cormac reached over and took the pot from her, poured for them both.
Their mother wasn't married, Catherine said. Only marital families were protected under the Constitution, according to the Supreme Court. An unmarried mother? It should have been much, much easier to remove the children.
But it wasn't.
Cormac offered her milk and sugar as he spoke, added it according to her direction, passed her the cup. She took it. Her phone, which she'd placed on the table, buzzed, and she glanced at it distractedly, then back at him.
But the children were obviously neglected. I was the 3rd social worker to see the family. The others had attended the family when they'd lived in Dublin and later in Galway, but those visits were to do with helping the family with money, dealing with rent and electricity arrears, that sort of thing. The notes on the file make it obvious that the neglect had been going on for a while. Mother advised about hygiene, that sort of thing.
But neglect wasn't enough to remove the children.
She shook her head.
Nowhere near enough.
I've seen much, much worse cases of neglect where we continue to support the family. What was different about your visit?
A teacher at the school called the office. Maud had a bruise on her arm, her forearm. It was a nasty one. And the teacher, her name was Carey or Carew, something like that. She suspected abuse and called it in. The case was assigned to me and I called to the house.
Cormac waited. Catherine took a sip of tea, then continued.
As I said, it could have been worse. The little boy, Jack, was okay. There was some food for him. It was the young girl, Maud. She looked after him, though she tried to deny it at first, claimed her mother did most of it. When I got there, Hilaria was asleep in bed. I tried to wake her and couldn't.
Catherine wrinkled her nose.
She was in a state. That sour smell of old sweat and stale vomit.
God, it was awful. She had urinated on herself. Probably wasn't the first time. There was an empty vodka bottle beside her bed, another on the floor. God knows how much she was drinking a day. I gather that's where most of the dole money went. Eventually Maud admitted that she cared for Jack after school. Did the food shopping, cooking, cleaning. Everything, really. She claimed that Hilaria stayed off the booze during the day, that she minded Jack while Maud was at school. But I'd say the poor child fended for himself. He was so little, only a toddler, really. Later I found out that Maud had been a good student, but had started to miss more and more school. I suppose she'd begun to realise that she couldn't leave Jack at home alone with her mother. Maud cared for that little boy incredibly well for such a young girl. I suppose she would have been 12, maybe 13.
When was this?
Cormac asked. He took his notebook out. She thought for a moment. I think towards the end of 1990.
12, then,
Cormac said. Catherine nodded. She had some food in the house. There was a banana in the fridge, a small bag of porridge, two sausages wrapped in cling film, half a pint of milk. Nearly broke my heart. She was very thin herself, and so solemn. She just looked at me. She didn't trust me or distrust me. She was just indifferent. She didn't expect anyone to help her. But she held that boy's hand every moment that I was there.
Did you talk to her about the bruises?
Catherine looked at him. Is she all right, Maud? Have you seen her? Cormac nodded slowly.
She's all right.
He said nothing more, and after a moment Catherine continued. I asked her about the bruise, made her show me. The bruise was very bad, but she told me she helped out a neighbour with the milking sometimes, and she'd had a kick from a cow. She was adamant that it was an accident, that no one had hurt her.
Did you believe her?
No. She had that look about her. I wasn't very experienced, but I was experienced enough to know what I was seeing. And the little boy was afraid of me, not just shy, genuinely afraid.
Did you... you left them?
Cormac asked in as neutral a tone as he could manage. I didn't have a mobile and there was no phone in the house. I took the kids back with me to the office, put them in the family room. I went to my desk to call the doctor for Hilaria, for the kids too. My boss was there. Someone had called him, told him where I'd been. He had a shit fit. Said removing the children was totally over the top. Unwarranted interference, something like that. She rubbed at her forehead, smoothing her left eyebrow hard with the index finger of her left hand again and again. I tried to tell him, I really did. He wouldn't listen. Said whether or not the mother was ill, we had no legal right to interfere. He said that the children were in good shape, and that there was a neighbour, a good Christian woman, who was heavily involved with the family and who was providing adequate supervision.
Who?
He didn't tell me, but I found out later. Her name was Keane, I think. Mrs. Keane. I think she must have called him, must have known somehow that I had taken the children. Cormac shook his head. It didn't make sense. Even in the context of the times, surely temporarily removing two young children from a house where there was no responsible adult was the necessary thing to do. Not to mention seeking medical help for Hilaria.
Why?
He asked. I don't know. My boss was very involved with the church, and Mrs. Keane seemed to have a lot of influence with him. But they were all like that. There were three others in that office, and none of them would even discuss the case. They just blocked those kids out. You have to understand, we were all so overworked, and there was this mindset that the standard of proof the courts required was so high. So we focused on keeping families together, even when the children might have been better off in care.
What happened then?
Cormac asked. He told me to bring them back. She wiped a tear away with the back of her hand.
Did you?
She shook her head, then nodded. I promised them I'd be back. Swore I would. Said I would be back before it got dark. That I would bring them food. McDonald's, I think I said. Maud wouldn't even look at me. They just sat in the back seat holding hands. The little boy was so scared.
But you didn't go back?
No. He said nothing.
I called Dublin the next day. Left the office to do it because I was too afraid, didn't want to be overheard. But I called the head office. They said that they would send someone down probably the next day, maybe the day after. I felt sick thinking of those kids in that house alone with their mother. I called again a few weeks later, but no one ever went. And by then I had 20 cases and more on the way. I was overwhelmed, so I did nothing. She couldn't meet his eyes. He wondered how often she had woken in the night, how often she had held her own children to her and had thought about the two she left behind.
Did you see any sign of drugs in the house? Any heroin?
No, nothing like that. I was surprised when I heard. But I suppose I was mostly relieved. And I heard that Jack was fostered almost immediately, which was very good.
You kept track of the children?
He asked. But she looked away. Not really. Just heard a few things from an old colleague. After a moment she stood and walked to the sink, taking her cup with her. I'm sorry, but I have to go, she said.
The neighbor, Mrs. Keane, did she stay involved with the family?
I believe so. I heard that she collected Hilaria's dole. I suppose it was the unmarried mother's allowance in those days. You could do that then. Hilaria was getting disability allowance as well, so she probably picked that up too. Cormac didn't close his notebook.
Do you think Keane would have bought alcohol for Hilaria Blake? She must have had a source once she reached the point where she couldn't or wouldn't get to the village herself.
Catherine hesitated. I can't imagine she would have. She was supposed to be very religious. She picked up her handbag from the countertop. I'm sorry, I really do have to go. Cormac stood. As he followed her to the front door, he asked,
Did you know much about heroin use in the town back then? Was it much of a problem?
Not that I can remember. Most of our problems were alcohol-related.
You never heard that Hilaria used heroin?
She shook her head as she opened the door. He followed her into the bright spring sunshine. It was still cold, but he welcomed the fresh air and the sight of blue sky. The rain in Galway was so much more constant than in Dublin. It was hard to believe the cities were only a few hours apart. Suddenly he wished he were back in Dublin, in the grotty but familiar surroundings of Dublin Castle. I'm so sorry, she said. Will you tell her that?
You mean Maud?
Yes.
I will, he said, but he didn't mean it. Whatever else he had to say to Maud, he had no urge to remind her of another person who had failed her.
Chapter 17. Cormac went for a run immediately after the Catherine Shelley interview. He needed to move, to push his body, to sweat out his frustration and anger. There was nothing he could do about what happened to Maud and Jack. That was a 20-year-old story, and he knew better than most that the system was still failing today. He also knew better than to let this sort of shit get to him. Getting emotional helped no one. It didn't make you a better cop. It meant clouded judgment. It meant that you looked for evidence to justify your feelings instead of pursuing the facts. But this case got to him. Maybe it was because it was a case from his past. At 20 years old, he'd had no tough outer skin. His gear bag was in the boot of the car. He'd put it there on Monday morning, but had gone to the pub after work instead of the gym. He didn't feel like the gym now either. It was in the basement of the station at Mill Street, and the last thing he needed was to encounter Brian Murphy. But he used its changing room, then took his frustration outside. Cormac cut down Dominic Street and over the canal, its water murky in the heavy weather. Then down Father Griffin Road and onwards until he reached the sea. It started raining as he ran along the prom, and the ever-present walkers thinned out. Cormac kept his pace up until his heart thundered and his breath was tight in his lungs. It was about 4 kilometres to Blackrock Diving Tower, and he pushed his pace until he got there, then turned and took a slower pace back to the station. His knees were complaining, but otherwise he felt good. Better. A quick shower and change at the station, and he was back in the car heading for home. His phone rang just as he pulled in and parked outside the little terraced house on Canal Road that he shared with Emma. The number was blocked.
Riley, he said.
There was a bustle of conversation from the other end of the phone. Background noise of a phone ringing.
Cormac,
a voice said.
Hang on.
The background noise retreated as the voice changed locations.
Cormac, you still there?
It was Matt, an old friend and colleague. He worked international liaison, essentially Interpol, and had contacts in the United States. He owed Cormac a favor or two.
Yeah, still here, Matt. I have something for you. That was quick,
Cormac said.
Yeah, well, it's getting harder to get information from that side of the world since 9/11, but what you're looking for is pretty straightforward. Plain old, uncomplicated murder. Tell me. You asked for anything that fit the profile between 75 and 85. There was a murder in 1983. 16-year-old student attended the St. Boniface School. She went to soccer practice as usual, never made it home. Body was found the next day. She'd been raped and strangled. Her boyfriend was the chief suspect. She'd told her friend she was planning on breaking it off, but he was cleared eventually. Wrong blood type.
Her body wasn't hidden.
I didn't ask,
Matt said.
Does it matter?
Check something else for me, Matt, Cormac asked. Matt had no problem with that, and Cormac asked him to check if a Timothy Lanigan had been questioned in the disappearance. He almost rang off then, but something occurred to him.
Matt, what's the word on the ground about Anthony Healy? Anything new?
A pause.
Why are you asking?
Was there caution in Matt's tone?
He's working out of Galway on the task force. And? And nothing. Something feels a little off there, that's all. I haven't heard anything, Cormac. At least nothing more than the usual.
The usual was the stuff that had been floating around Healy for years. That Healy might be inclined to take the odd shortcut, might have a fondness for pavement hostesses, as Cormac's old boss called the working girls. That wasn't great. Apart from the fact that prostitution was illegal, there was an inequality about that relationship that turned Cormac's stomach.
You sure? Yeah, Cormac, sorry mate, I have to go.
And a moment later, Cormac had dial tone in his ear. By the time Cormac made his way to the house, he'd cooled down and started to feel stiff. He was hungry and pleasantly surprised to open the door to the smell of dinner cooking.
Em?
He called.
Kitchen!
She called back, and he found her there, cheeks flushed, the room warm from the heat of the oven. She smiled at him, came forward for a hug and a kiss. Her hair was still damp from the shower. He held her close for a moment, breathed her in. When he let her go, she turned back to the food she was preparing. Cormac sat and unlaced his boots.
That smells fantastic, he said.
It did. Emma liked to cook when she had time. It's my standard special, I'm afraid, she said. You'll be sick of it, but I wanted to make something nice, and my imagination deserted me.
I wasn't expecting you.
3 late nights in a row is enough, she said. She gave him another smile over her shoulder. Cormac got a wine glass from the cupboard, poured himself a glass from the bottle open on the kitchen table, then returned to his seat and watched her work. She was turning a lamb rack in the pan, browning it. She had already put potatoes in the oven, had herbed breadcrumbs ready. He watched her press the crust to the rack, every movement neat and precise, before putting the lot in the oven. Ta-da! She said, turning to him, picking up her own wine glass from the counter. 20 minutes and we can eat. She sat opposite him, reached one socked foot under the kitchen table, and rested it on his lap.
Work's going well?
He asked. Getting there. Lab's good to go. Interviews for the last 2 researcher positions start tomorrow, and I am taking the whole weekend off. She made a face. I know I've been a bit useless lately, total workaholic, but I promise things will settle down. She kept talking, suggesting possible plans for the weekend ahead. Go to Dublin Friday evening, see some friends. There was a rugby match. If he fancied it, he should go while she got some shopping in and they could meet for an early, boozy dinner after. Or if he didn't feel like the trip, maybe they'd just hang out in Galway, do a bit more exploring. Cormac was distracted, his mind wandering back to the Catherine Shelley interview as she spoke.
What about Danny? She asked. Did you ask him for dinner? We could have them here if you like, or just meet in town.
I'm not sure about that, he said. I've asked him again, but he hasn't said whether or not he can do it.
Maybe Sarah doesn't want to. She doesn't know us. Maybe she'd rather just stay at home with her kids.
Maybe, said Cormac.
He wasn't going to tell her that he suspected Danny was cheating. He didn't want that image in her head, that cliché of the cheating cop using the job as an excuse every time he had to work nights. Emma got up to check on the food, and the conversation died. Was she pissed off?
I can ask him again, he said.
It doesn't matter, she said. She started to put plates together, and he got up to help. He almost told her about Lorna McIntyre and the possibility that she was missing. But she'd already changed the subject, and he didn't want to bring the mood down on what might be their only night in together this week. When they sat down to eat, they talked about incidentals. They finished the first bottle, and Cormac took a second from the wine rack without really thinking about it. When he had sat down and poured for them both, he turned the conversation to the Blake case, and Emma listened, her grey eyes serious.
It was hard to listen to. Not that she didn't have a point. Worse things happen today, where something gets missed or a child slips through the cracks, and this was 20 years ago. It's easy to forget how much has changed.
But, Emma said. Cormac grimaced.
I don't know. It's hard to listen to from someone who is part of it, you know. She was too quick with the excuses.
They fell quiet for some time then, Cormac lost in his thoughts, Emma watching him. Eventually she spoke.
You don't usually talk about your cases, she said. There was empathy in her eyes, and sadness. This one is different for you, isn't it?
Christ, Em, he said.
He got up and poured a glass of water from the tap, drank and turned to her.
Sorry.
He smiled at her.
Very dramatic.
So much for his plan to keep the mood upbeat. She hesitated, then shrugged.
I'd much rather know than not, if there's something on your mind. We don't have to talk about it. But it's better for me if you can tell me enough so that I understand at least a bit of what's going on with you when things are difficult.
If he told her a quarter of the shit he saw, it would break her heart. She'd grown up in a house of privilege, and though she'd had her own trauma, it was different. One shocking, even horrific, incident did not undo a lifetime of love and care and plenty. Cormac reminded himself that he'd had more than his fair share of love and care himself, if not so much of the plenty.
It's Jack, he said. So many of the kids we see, even the ones who go into care, what they go through before we get to them, they never fully recover. Jack was one of the few kids to get out intact.
He stopped talking, didn't want to finish the sentence. But if he committed suicide, even years later, it means none of them are safe. She finished for him.
Yeah.
She nodded, then changed the subject. It shocked him sometimes how well she knew him. She could delve straight into him, right to the center, then pull back and move on before he realized she was there. They talked for a little longer, then went to bed. Emma turned to him with a warmth and desire that easily matched his own, and for a short time, the Blake case and station politics were washed clear from his mind. She fell asleep quickly afterwards, lying on her side with her face turned away from him, her body utterly limp and relaxed. He ran a hand down her back, warm, velvet-soft skin, and she sighed in her sleep. His eyes traced the scar that ran along her jaw. She'd had to have surgery to reset it. A fainter, spider-like scar started at the very edge of her forehead and ran back under her hairline. Emma shifted in the bed beside him, then sighed again, and seemed to settle back into a deeper sleep. Cormac lay down on his back, one hand behind his head, and stared up at the ceiling. He had to find a way to make Galway work. He would take these shitty cases and make them shine. He was dropping off to sleep when his phone buzzed. A message from Matt, with a link. No subject, no text. He clicked on the link, and it brought him to the website of The Independent. Seconds later, he was looking at Healy's grinning face.
In the photograph, Healy was wearing a reflective Garda vest and a hard hat as he stood beside a front loader that was pushing plastic-wrapped bags of something into the teeth of an incinerator. Cormac scrolled down to read the caption. Gardaí destroy more than €2 million worth of drugs. Scroll down further to the article, which was dated the 11th of March, 2012. Detective Sergeant Anthony Healy watches as €2 million worth of cannabis plants, crack cocaine, and heroin is incinerated. This enormous haul had been recovered from the North Dublin area by Gardaí over the last 6 months. It was taken to a local incinerator by officers and destroyed today. Seizing these drugs has meant that we have stopped them getting onto the streets of Dublin, said Detective Sergeant Anthony Healy. Today is the culmination of months of work. We need the help of the public if we are to continue to have this level of success. I urge people to use the confidential tip line if they have any suspicions about drug activity. Cormac turned off the screen and put his phone down, then lay back on his pillow and stared again at the ceiling. Matt had sent that for a reason, and it wasn't so that Cormac could admire Healy's sterling work. This was confirmation. Healy was up to something, and whatever it was had something to do with that drug haul. It was equally clear that Matt wasn't in a position to give him any more. Maybe there was an ongoing operation. No, if Cormac was going to do anything about Healy, he was going to have to do it alone. Thursday, 28th of March, 2013. Chapter 18. Cormac sat at his desk, typing up his meeting with Catherine Shelley and thinking about the text message he'd just received from Emma. She wanted to know if he was on for going to Dublin or not. He didn't want to go and wasn't sure why. Maybe it was just that he didn't want to head back and see friends until he had stuff sorted out in Galway. The Blake case was moving forward, but he was following the slimmest of threads, which might snap at any moment. Going to Dublin would mean leaving early on Friday, and he didn't want to be out of the station right now. Something was going on with Healy, and whatever he was involved in had him under pressure. There was a burst of laughter from the other side of the room.